KaiserNetwork.org.
Good day. I'm Jill Braden-Balderas with KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks for tuning in to Ask the Experts, our regular live web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with top experts. Today, we turn our attention to the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States, human papillomavirus, the major cause of cervical cancer. In June of last year, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first vaccine against HPV, Merck's Gardasil, for women and girls ages 9 to 26. This vaccine prevents HPV infection with the strains causing about 70% of cervical cancer, and it has now been added to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's recommended immunization schedule for girls ages 11 and 12. The CDC has also recommended catch-up vaccinations for girls and women ages 13 to 26. So what are the challenges facing clinicians and both federal and state policymakers as the vaccine gets implemented? Are insurance companies covering it, and what are the financing options for low-income and uninsured women and girls? And with minority populations bearing much of the cervical cancer burden in the United States, how can their access to the vaccine be facilitated? We're sure you've got other questions, too, so email us at ask@KaiserNetwork.org. That's ask@KaiserNetwork.org. Or call 1-888-524-7378. In our studio today are Dr. Ann Schuchat, Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, Dr. Renee Jenkins, Professor and Chair of Howard University College of Medicine's Department of Pediatrics and Child Health. She's also President-elect of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And Dr. Alina Selganikoff, Vice President and Director of Women's Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Ann Schuchat, I'll start with you. First of all, can you tell us about what this vaccine's efficacy and safety record is?
Right. This is a vaccine that's been studied in thousands of girls and women around the world, including almost 10,000 here in the United States. It turns out to be quite safe in terms of local reactions and systemic activity, things like fever and severe problems. We really haven't seen any severe adverse events associated with the vaccine in the pre-licensure use of it. But, of course, many of the rare kinds of adverse events would only show up after a vaccine is given out to millions and millions of people. So we need to keep tracking that after the vaccine is used more broadly. The efficacy has been extremely exciting. The studies that have been done have looked at immune response, and they've also looked at effect in reducing acquisition of the HPV virus and reducing the precancerous lesions that are precursors to cervical cancer. The studies haven't been carried out long enough, and of course we take interventions so that women won't develop cervical cancer if there are precancerous lesions that are found, but the efficacy is very, very high. So the general results of the efficacy studies are that this vaccine prevents getting HPV infection, but it does not prevent, it does not treat the HPV infection that you've already gotten. So if you're already exposed and infected with the HPV virus, you are not going to have that go away because you've gotten the vaccine. That's one of the reasons we recommend giving the vaccine to young girls before they've actually ever been exposed to the virus.
But there are almost 100 strains, is that correct, of HPV? So even if someone has been exposed to HPV, it's likely that it might not be one of the four that's in the vaccine, is that correct?
Right. This vaccine includes four types of HPV, 16 and 18, which cause 70% of cervical cancer, and 6 and 11, which cause 90% of genital warts. So this vaccine, we think, will be quite effective at preventing those four types of HPV, but there are actually, as you say, about 100 different types out there. So a really important message for clinicians and parents and women is that you still need to get cervical screening for, you need to get your pap smears done, because this vaccine will not prevent 100% of cervical cancer. We really need to keep up the routine recommendations to prevent cervical cancer with routine screening.
Now, how is the vaccine administered?
It's administered intramuscularly through, you know, usually a shot in the arm. It's given in a three-dose schedule, so you would get it today and then 2 months from now and 6 months from now. And it's important, we think, that you complete the series because the studies that show that high efficacy are looking at after the full three doses. We don't know whether just one or two doses would be enough, and so we really think it's important that girls and women get the full protection of the three doses.
And what if someone doesn't stick with the actual vaccine schedule? Is this kind of like the hepatitis B vaccine where you can actually have wait a little bit more time than the recommended time and it's still efficacious?
Right. Now, if you've gotten a dose and then you totally forget and you don't come back in 2 months, do you have to start it again with your first dose? No, you just need to get the series of three. We think it's important that the second dose not be given shorter than 1 month after the first, and ideally is 2 months after the first, and that the third dose be given 6 months after the first. But basically, the key point is that you don't have to start from the beginning again, but do go back and get that second and third doses and finish it up.
Now, the advisory committee, it's the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, arrived at the age range of 11 to 26 as the target group and only in women. Why did they arrive at this conclusion?
The Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices made recommendations on the routine use of this vaccine based on the scientific data that were available. There were clinical trial data of immune response, antibody levels, and there were data on effectiveness against preventing HPV infection and precursors to cervical cancer. And there was also a lot of information reviewed about sexual behavior, particularly in the United States in girls and women. And it turns out that this vaccine will work best if given before you have the onset of sexual activity. And that varies in everybody. You know, we don't know exact onset of sexual activity in any particular person. But at a population level, by targeting girls 11 to 12, we should reach almost everybody before sexual activity. Now, why girls? Why not boys? Don't they get HPV problems? And certainly boys can get genital warts, and there's some kinds of cancers that men can get from this virus. On the other hand, the science, the evidence base that we had at the time of the recommendations did not extend to the boys and men. And so the company is studying the vaccine in men right now, and we're looking forward to seeing the results of those studies. But we don't yet have effectiveness studies carried out in men, and so there's not a recommendation that can be science-based.
And then what about babies? We had several questions. Why not include this actually in the recommendations for infants? Is there a particular reason why? Has it just not been studied in that population either?
You know, I think as a country, we're really used to babies getting vaccines, and we always think, how about another one? Why don't we add something onto the baby schedule? The baby schedule's getting pretty crowded, and there's actually a number of other vaccines that we suggest people 11 to 12 get. There's a vaccine against meningitis, meningococcal meningitis, that we recommend for the 11 to 12-year-old population. And there's a new vaccine that's a booster vaccine for whooping cough that also has the old tetanus and diphtheria shots in it. So it's one dose with tetanus, diphtheria, acellular pertussis, or whooping cough. So we think the 11 to 12-year-old age group is a great time to get vaccines. The other thing about why not go for the babies is that we don't know how long this vaccine is going to protect for. The studies so far have followed some people as long as 5 years, and they're intended to go out to 10 to 15 years. But we're trying to protect girls and women for many, many years. And if we were to start at, you know, age 2 months, that's asking quite a lot more of the vaccine. So one of the things that will be studied after the vaccine is in wider spread use is the duration of protection and whether we might need to add a booster in the future at some point.
Now, Alina Salganikov, this is not a cheap vaccine. It's about $360 for
120 a dose. Yeah,
120 a dose. So a total of $360. Can you talk about what are the financing options for the women who are recommended to get this vaccine? And can you first of all just start off by talking about girls in the 11 to 18 age group and what their options are, and then women 19 to 26.
Absolutely, and I think it's important to distinguish that the financing issues and options are very different for these two groups. For girls basically 18 and under, there are actually rich sources of financing. We have the Vaccines for Children program, which is a federal entitlement program that covers children on Medicaid, children who are uninsured, and underinsured as well. That is, if you have insurance coverage but your insurance doesn't pay for vaccines, you have coverage there, as well as private insurance. For the older women, private insurance is a venue, as well as Medicaid in some states.
Now, what are some of the options that states are actually looking into? A number of different states have been considering things in their legislature, and then some governors have also been taking some initiatives on providing this vaccine. Can you talk a little bit about what some states are doing?
In terms of the mandates?
Yes.
Well, I mean, part of the issue here is how do we make sure that girls and women have access to this vaccine? So some of the states have introduced, and I think it's six, maybe even more states. Actually, yesterday, the District of Columbia just introduced legislation that would require a mandate for 11- and 12-year-old girls to get the vaccine. That's one option, and they found that mandates are actually very effective in terms of high coverage. There are other issues, and we can talk a little bit more about that later, about involved in mandates. The other is around the financing, and some states have actually set up pools, like New Hampshire, and I think most recently South Dakota, set up a pool so that all girls have access to the vaccine for free.
So what are the different funding sources? So the federal funding sources and then state funding sources and then private funding sources for vaccines.
Again, there are the issues are very different for girls as opposed to young women that are over 18. For the children, you have the Vaccines for Children program, which, as I said, is a federal entitlement program. And girls will be covered who are eligible, and those are girls who are under 18, who are either uninsured or covered by Medicaid, or who are underinsured, as well as Native Americans. So all of those children have financial access to it, either through their doctors or, in the case of uninsured or underinsured girls, they can go to public clinics and get the vaccine. The insurance coverage, in most cases, will cover. We really don't know. A lot of the insurance plans right now are making their policies, but anecdotally we've heard it, that at least for the girls, that the private insurance is covering it. Although what co-pays and deductibles are associated with that is an issue and will likely affect affordability. As you said, it's $360, which doesn't even include the administration fee, which is paying the doctor to do that. For the older women, it's really, there's fewer sources. First of all, this is an age range where women are at much higher risk for being uninsured. 29% of women, actually, in the 19 to 26-year-old group have no health insurance coverage. Another, I think about 14% of them have Medicaid coverage. For adults, vaccines are an optional coverage. So each state makes a decision about whether or not they're going to cover the vaccine for this group of women. Then you have the women who have private insurance. About 10% of them have individual insurance policies. They have not historically been very good at covering preventive services and like vaccines, so they may not have coverage for this. And then you have another half who have private insurance coverage. But again, we're hearing some anecdotal evidence that not all plans are covering the vaccine for this older age group, and so they actually may be liable for the cost themselves.
Now, Renee Jenkins, in terms of getting the girls who are in the 11 to 12 age range actually in to get vaccinated, what are some of the challenges that you face in your practice and then also as a representative of the American Academy of Pediatrics in getting people in to get vaccinated?
Well, I think there are vaccines that you've pointed out that are really required now by school. The Tdap is required. Minactra is not fully required, but we are used to bringing on our periodicity schedule youngsters in at this age for a well-child check, and part of that is vaccinating them. So this is not out of the ordinary in terms of asking them to come in at this age group.
Now, there have been some studies out there that have shown that about 40% of U.S. women, only 40% of U.S. women, have even heard of HPV. Mm-hmm. And then of those people who've heard of HPV, only 20% know that it's associated with cervical cancer. So how important is it to actually educate kids and more likely their parents mm-hmm. about the importance of protecting against HPV and then the link to cervical cancer?
I think the educational piece is very important. I think we're really trying to do that. I think there is more discussion about it now. And so I think a lot of parents are really asking their physicians when they come in. I did sort of a little poll of my Society for Adolescent Medicine colleagues through a listserv and said, you know, what are people's experiences? And a number of people have said parents are coming in asking for this vaccine. And especially for middle-class parents who aren't really always clear about whether their insurance covers it, mm-hmm. they are willing to pay for this. I think they see it as an incredible strategy, an opportunity to prevent their daughters from having cervical cancer.
Now, we received a lot of emails about whether or not this vaccine is actually in stock. So in your practice at Howard, do you all keep the vaccine in stock?
Right now, we are waiting till the VFC comes through with it because we do not want to have vaccine only for commercially insured patients and not be able to give it to Medicaid patients. So we have it ready to go for an order as soon as VFC starts coming in.
And VFC is vaccines for children.
Yes, mm-hmm. right. And the majority of our patients qualify for VFC. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to, you know, have a stock of vaccine and say, oh, you can get it, but you can't get it. So we're waiting for that.
Yeah, and I would just add a comment that we do have a government contract for the, a federal contract for the VFC purchased vaccine. So states and local authorities would be able to get vaccine to get it, make it available to providers through that contract. So that came through towards the end of last fall.
Right. So we'll expect to get it in a month or so, hopefully.
Yeah, and it would depend on the city and the state and, you know, what the details are. But you know, we've heard from the manufacturer that the supply is ample and that there now are mechanisms mm-hmm. for the, both the private and public sector to access the vaccine. But as my colleague said, whether all the insurers and the private payers have caught up with the recommendations or not may depend.
Anecdotally, I've heard from in California that there's still a lot of supply issues that
right.
in terms of at least private practice
right.
physicians
okay.
not having it and also not having a lot of information
right.
about it. I think that there's still a big learning curve mm-hmm. that we need
yeah.
to really overcome.
I also think until people know what their flow is going to be in terms of ordering it, they do not want to lay out that much money for a supply if people aren't going to really come in and ask for it. So I think there are lots of issues, especially for smaller practices who don't have that great margin mm-hmm. to determine whether they really want to stock up with this vaccine.
Mm-hmm. So what would be the risk, say, for a private doctor who decided to stock the vaccine and then might not, would it be not getting reimbursed from the insurance company for
well,
months
I think,
or?
Yeah, exactly. Part of it is the flow of how quickly you get reimbursed. And then if it's not a mandated vaccine, whether in fact your population is going to want to get it or not. So I think, you know, you've got to decide if you want to take that risk financially to purchase a large stock of vaccine.
Now, Ann Schuckett, you were talking about how the federal government actually does have a contract now with the vaccines for children suppliers, people who are actually giving out those vaccines. What is the government doing to educate private physicians mm-hmm. about this vaccine? Because we did receive a number of emails of misinformation that patients mm-hmm. felt like they got from their private doctors, even OBGYNs who might not know everything there is to know about the vaccine and why people should get it, or if it's even available, or how they can get it and get it to their patients.
Yeah, I think this is an incredibly exciting but also difficult challenge in terms of implementation of this vaccine. The education of providers is critical. We have a lot of different groups that are used to reaching out to both providers and the public about sexually transmitted infections, about cancer, about immunization, and this is an issue that brings us all together. One of the really exciting features of the Vaccine for Children program is the quality assurance and education opportunities that it involves. The VFC, or Vaccine for Children's program, isn't just a public health department kind of thing. It turns out that 75% of the Vaccine for Children providers are private providers. By actually getting vaccines from the VFC program, providers need to be visited periodically to have their vaccine management, storage, handling, and their practice monitored. So there are an enormous amount of hands-on educational opportunities through the VFC program that reach providers who are caring for private patients as well as public patients. If you look at the pediatric use of vaccines in the United States, 90% of pediatric doses of vaccines are given out by people who are enrolled in the VFC program. But one of our new challenges is that the VFC program has mainly been giving out shots or vaccines to young children. And teenagers don't necessarily go to the same doctor that they used to when they were a baby or a young child. Mm-hmm. There's actually less use of routine preventive health services in the teen population. As you get older, girls and boys stop going to the doctor every year or every whatever, however often, although we have had this 11 to 12 routine well-child visit for a while. And so one of the things that the VFC program will be doing is trying to enroll new providers and enroll gynecologists, enroll more family physicians, people who do care for those teenage group, and try to help get tracking their storage and handling and administration of vaccine out there. But there's some nice partnerships going on between the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Society of Adolescent Medicine and CDC and the state health departments and the family physician organizations to try to get common messages that won't be confusing, but that will get the parent or the woman the information she needs when she shows up at her doctor's office. But we're not finished yet. We have a lot of work to do.
Now, in terms of the messaging and everyone working together, we received a couple of different emails to that extent. One of them was incorporating sexual behavior messages. One of the questions was, what efforts should and will be taken to address the importance of behavioral changes in addition to getting vaccinated for HPV? So incorporating healthy sexual messages to teens. Renee Jenkins, if you could talk about the importance of that.
I think that is a standard of care for adolescents to breach those type of topics. First of all, with a parent, to make sure parents starting to feel more comfortable talking to their youngsters about some of this. And secondly, to have a confidential conversation with a young person about reproductive health risks, sexually transmitted disease, substance abuse, all those kinds of things that are risks for adolescents.
And then another one of the issues, too, that people were really concerned about is screening. Mm-hmm. And now that we have a vaccine for cervical cancer, are women going to think that they don't need to get screened to have a pap smear? And we talked a little bit earlier in the show that this might even be an opportunity, too, to review the recommendations now that it's actually 3 years
right.
for a pap smear as opposed to 1 year,
right.
which is what it used to be.
Right.
So can you also talk about incorporating in these screening messages as well?
I think those screening messages are important. And it's been such a change for people to go from as soon as the youngster is sexually active to do a pap smear to now wait for the 3 years. And part of that message was because of HPV and the transient nature of infections with HPV. And we were sort of being really intense about following up on them, and then it would disappear, and you have kids getting colposcopies or special examinations for cancer. And it turned out that that really wasn't necessary. But we, first of all, know that we still have to screen for chlamydia, regardless of waiting the 3 years for cancer screening, because chlamydia is, again, a very highly prevalent sexually transmitted disease in teenagers who've had sexual activity. So, again, the screening is not limited to just cancer screening. There's lots of screening, HIV screening that we have to do. So the screening message as well as the behavioral change message is sort of part of the package of well child or well adolescent, content that we really have to have.
Now, going back to the financing issue a little bit, Alina Solganikov, could you talk about the Merck program for women who are qualified for the program that would most likely be low income and probably uninsured or underinsured? What are the options for them with the Merck program?
From what I understand, Merck has a vaccine assistance program that is targeted to low income, that's women below 200% of the poverty level, who are low income and uninsured. Not underinsured, but uninsured. And the program assists those women who go to office-based physicians who participate in the Merck program. So that is actually a very small slice of the population. I did some quick analysis on looking at California, for example, where basically if you look at low-income uninsured women, only 15% of women actually get most of their care from office-based physicians. A lot of women, because they have such a high rate of being uninsured and because many of them actually rely on publicly funded providers and clinics, such as those that are funded by what we call Title X or Planned Parenthood type of clinics, those clinics at this point right now are not eligible to participate in the Merck program, from what I understand.
Now, we actually also got an email as well about that. Are they going to be, the Title V and the Title X clinics, will they be eligible for any federal funding for this HPV vaccine?
At this point, my understanding is that Title X and Title V are not going to be paying for the vaccine. So they will likely not assist them. And many of these clinics are very underfunded in reality. They are really operating on very tight margins. So for them to even purchase this vaccine would really be a significant outlay for them. And so kind of my conversations with different people from different clinics and representing different clinic organizations really suggest that at this point, at least, they're not going to be able to afford to pay the money up front to supply the vaccines to then provide to their patients.
One other email that we got that I thought was a good question was, should the messaging for this vaccine be STD prevention or cervical cancer prevention? So, Ann Schuckert, if you could start with that.
You know, I think this is an incredible education opportunity. There's a lot one can talk about, and I think that my adolescent provider colleague here will be the expert. But I actually think it's pretty exciting to have a vaccine that prevents cervical cancer. HPV as a viral infection is a sexually transmitted infection. It can cause problems that aren't cancer. It can cause genital warts, but it also causes cancer. At least some of the types are cancer producers. So I think around vaccines, we try to educate about the benefits and risks of getting the product. What will you prevent, and what possible side effects might you go through? When you were focusing on sexual risk-taking, there's a lot of messages, way more than talking about vaccines, lots of things that providers or parents need to talk to their teens about. In terms of cancer prevention, there's a lot we can do, you know, in terms of our diet, in terms of our exposures, in terms of smoking. So I think we probably want to customize some of the issues to what the venue is. But certainly in the provider's office, this adolescent health visit, the 11 to 12-year-old visit, we think is a fantastic opportunity for all kinds of prevention messages. This is the age when teens are beginning to think about all kinds of risk-taking, and we know that teenagers tend to be very short-term in their thoughts. They're not thinking 30 years out to when they're going to get cancer. They're thinking about tomorrow at the most. So I think short-term messaging for the the teen, and perhaps a little bit of the long-term messaging for the parent.
Mm-hmm. And then the follow-up in this email was, what are good ways to actually frame some of this information to high school students? You, Renee Jenkins, work with high school students all the time.
Right.
What would you say about that?
I think they are getting pretty savvy and getting a lot of information about sexually transmitted infections. And I think to add HPV to that conversation in a much larger way, because it's such a prevalent infection. People estimate about 6.2 million infections a year. So this is not like a minor kind of infection. So I think sort of giving them the information about the HPV, but also stressing cancer prevention as a possibility. I mean, I don't think that's been out there before. I think that's why it's so exciting to have this vaccine. But again, I think it's all part of that package and that opportunity to bring up these issues of risk with the youngsters for the sexually transmitted disease risk, as well as the conversations we're now having about cancer risk. So I think we need to look at each opportunity to be able to get that message in. We should not say either or, we should say both.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because the Merck advertising campaign actually is geared more towards the cervical cancer aspect of it. So I don't know if you all have any comments on that. Or
I think it is, because I think it's primarily aimed, it seems to me, at the parents, at making a decision to get your child in, to get them immunized. Because, again, it's very often part of a family's health insurance plan to take a youngster in. And then we have the public, Medicaid patients who are eligible for VFC that come for their well-child checks. So I think we are looking at that as the parents really being the instrument for 11 and 12-year-olds to really come in. That's the vehicle. 11 and 12-year-olds don't walk through your door on their own.
Now, we just received an email from a reporter at the Washington Post about the state legislatures actually mandating this vaccine for entry into schools. Elias Alganikoff, you talked a little bit about this earlier, but can you just talk about what are some of the issues surrounding these mandates, including parental rights, and then actually the infrastructure? If they actually implement these mandates, all the issues that we've discussed here earlier, are insurance companies paying for it? Are providers actually stocking it? What are some of the issues that, if these mandates are actually enacted, that states are going to face?
Well, implementing a mandate is a lot more complicated than making a proclamation saying that it just should be so. And if you implement a school entry mandate, there are a lot of moving pieces that really need to be coordinated. I mean, you need to make sure that, one, that you have the financing infrastructure in place. For children, there is an infrastructure, but I would say that there are still children who may fall through the cracks, and so I think it's important to make sure that that's done. Then the other thing around the mandates is you've got three visits that are necessary. How do you make sure that that's actually been done? How do you have them? The school has to have an infrastructure to actually validate that and check that. And do you want to have a situation where you actually may have children who don't go to school because they didn't get the vaccine, when we're really trying to push kids to go to school? There are issues around kind of parental consent and parental consent to opt out. All the states that have mandates do have opportunities for parents to opt out, either for religious or moral exemptions, and every state has a slightly different policy, as is always the case. And so those are, you know, some of the really kind of larger issues around the mandates.
And you said earlier you think it's about six or eight states that
so far. I mean, I think that there's been a push by some organizations to really push the mandates. And the truth is, when you have a mandate, that is the most effective way to assure that you have very good coverage for a vaccine. There is kind of an enforcement mechanism behind that. So, it, you know, mandates work. There are a lot of other issues around mandates that some people do find objectionable.
Now, there was an article in the Washington Post today, and actually a doctor from the American Academy of Pediatrics was quoted saying that your organization is not in support of mandates just yet, and one of the concerns is safety. And he says, this is a new vaccine. It would be wise to wait until we have additional information about the safety of the vaccine. Why are you all not willing to support mandates yet? Or have you ever supported them in the past for other vaccines, or is it just specific to this HPV vaccine?
Yeah, I think it's preliminary. I think it's a real timing issue. This just came out. I think we are, in addition to the safety and, you know, how long is the vaccine going to be effective, also have the concerns. We had a conference call yesterday of the leadership about the issues that you talked about, not only about, you know, when parents have the option to opt out for various reasons, if they're allowed to do it, what kind of financial strain is this going to put on certain municipalities around being able to supply these vaccines. I think even though we've had some assurances about the supply, I think supply, we've had issues with all kinds of vaccine supplies. So people really aren't willing to sort of put that out there till we see really how this is going to flow. So I think in addition to the safety issue, there are some real logistic issues about mandates that I think we want to take it a little slowly and to see how this is going to roll out and to get a little experience with it.
Ann Schuckett, what do you think are some of the issues that would be really helpful to address in terms of improving these logistics issues from your standpoint, mm-hmm. since you're dealing with all the states?
Yeah. Well, I think there are a couple areas where we have some big challenges right now. One issue is tracking how we're doing. We have a pretty good system to know how we're doing with the immunization coverage in babies and toddlers. We have a national immunization survey, and in every state and in many city areas, we're able to tell every year how what proportion of the population has gotten the series of vaccines. But with adolescents, we're just at the infant stage mm-hmm. of being able to track coverage. We're beginning a pilot to try to track the receipt of immunizations in a sample, a national sample. So we're not anywhere close to having state-level data on adolescent immunizations, including HPV and the Menactra and Tdap, the three routine vaccines that begin at that age group. So in order to know how well we're doing and whether we need something like school requirements to help get us to a higher level at a state or national level, we really need better data than we have right now. I think the other thing you touched on earlier, which is the education and communication strategies, that this is hugely interesting to a number of stakeholders, and we're all trying to work together and be consistent, but I think we really need to focus on that and make sure that providers have the right information to give to their patients and the parents that they see, and that the public, women, as well as parents and teens, have the information they need. So I think we really need to get those pieces in place to be able to know whether we're doing well enough or really have pockets where we have gaps. The financing is also an issue that I think is important. The Vaccine for Children's program pays for about 45% of the pediatric doses of vaccines that are given in the country, and private insurance covers about 45% of the doses of vaccines that are given to children. States pick up about 5%, and then something called the Federal 317 program that goes to states picks up about 5%. But that's only all the way up through age 18 and doesn't do anything for the 19 to 26-year-old age group. So to know that this vaccine is able to reach all of the girls and women that will benefit from it, we really have to make sure the education's there, the tracking is there, and that the financing is there.
We actually got an email from someone in Ohio who just found out that their clinic won't be reimbursed from Medicaid for the HPV vaccine. So what would you say to someone who is just finding out that Medicaid is not going to pay for it? Are there other options for them to pursue to get women in this 18 to 26 age group who can't afford it or don't have private insurance to get it covered?
Sadly, there really are very few options. If she doesn't have private insurance, if she's on Medicaid, she probably is not. She's not going to qualify for the Merck program because she has insurance coverage through Medicaid. And if she doesn't have private insurance, so short of paying for it out of pocket, from where I sit, I don't really see that this young woman has a lot of options.
We also received an email from someone asking about what is the current status in regards to the number of insurance companies who are offering reimbursement for the vaccine. Do we know that yet?
We don't know that. We're going to be looking at that here at the Kaiser Family Foundation and doing some work looking at that, and also looking whether insurance companies make different choices based on their product line as well. Other research has shown that insurers, HMOs, for example, are more likely to cover preventive care than PPOs, although we've heard anecdotal evidence that the PPOs are covering it because it's more expensive and not the HMOs. So really, it's really too soon to tell. I think that a lot of the insurers right now are grappling with this. I think there's people are excited about this vaccine, and I think there is increasing demand from patients, and I think it will come from patients and from providers as well.
And one of the issues I think we should address also is the disparities issue here in terms of access, but then also cervical cancer burden. Mm-hmm. And even in the District of Columbia here, I think the rate is 13 per 100,000 women who get cervical cancer versus the national average, mm-hmm. which I think is around 8.8 mm-hmm. per 100,000 women. So Renee Jenkins, can you first of all talk about the burden that minority communities face when it comes to actually getting cervical cancer?
Right. I think I had a chance to look at some global data, and globally, Vietnamese women have one of the highest rates of cervical cancer. So it's very variable by ethnic groups. So it's not just, sort of the black issue. Also, Latino women have high rates of prevalence of cervical cancer. But the highest rates within the United States in terms of deaths or mortality from cervical cancer is in the African American community right now. And so, making sure that it's access is given for all ethnic groups, I think, is going to be important, but especially those who we already see are at high risk from dying from cervical cancer.
Are there ways that you can think of to suggest improving that access?
Well, I think the access is not just for the vaccine. As we've talked about, the access is really going to be for cervical cancer screening. The biggest drop that occurred over time really was from the time women started getting screened. And now the cancer that we're seeing are what we call in situ, or cancer that is very localized as opposed to widespread cancer, which used to occur before we had cervical screening. Mm-hmm. So cervical screening cannot lose its importance in sort of this enthusiasm about the vaccine. We cannot lose track of really advising for women according to the schedule set up by the American College of OBGYN to continue to get screened.
Right. Prior to the PAP screening, a cancer death cervical cancer was the leading cause of cancer death among women in the United States, and now actually in many developing countries. And I think that this is where the vaccine has very exciting potential. But again, the affordability issue will also be, I think, a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to add a comment, in the pediatric population, the Vaccine for Children's program has been an incredible mm-hmm. tool to narrow or at times eliminate disparities in terms of the vaccine-preventable diseases. It turns out among that 70% of African American children and 70% of Latino children are in the VFC program or are eligible for Vaccine for Children, for essentially free access to vaccines. And this past fall, we announced with this national immunization survey that the traditional vaccine series no longer had a gap between blacks and whites, that we'd narrowed to zero the gap in immunization coverage. But immunization is only one piece, and we need to have cervical screening continue in terms of the adult population. So I think having a strong childhood and adolescent immunization program will be a great step forward in handling some of these disparities, because some of the most the largest access problems have been overcome through this entitlement program. But the older young woman, the 19 to 26-year-old, is still at risk there. And while, you know, in 50 years, this 11 to 12-year-old program will have covered everybody, we really have an opportunity now for those 19 to 26-year-old women to be protected. And I think we as a country really want to make sure that happens.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the women who are going to have the greatest problems in accessing the vaccine are often going to be the same women who later on are going to be the less likely to get their pap smears mm-hmm. and subsequently develop cervical cancer. Women who are poor, women of color, immigrant women are the women who, you know, I really think are going to have the greatest problems in getting the vaccine.
But I think that just like HIV, I think really opened up the opportunity to talk about sexuality mm-hmm. in many fronts, that's what this really does, mm-hmm. and we should not lose the opportunity
Absolutely.
To really begin to talk about cervical cancer screening for young women now that people are so excited about this vaccine. So I think we're trying to, and I think this show is an example of it being a really exciting opportunity, and we need to make the best of it.
Now, Renee Jenkins, you mentioned that you were looking at some international statistics. We did get an email saying 93% of the deaths from cervical cancer mm-hmm. occur in low and middle-income countries, mm-hmm. but often they are the last ones mm-hmm. to actually get access to these vaccines. So does anyone want to comment on how women in other countries who are at most risk of getting cervical cancer and dying from it can actually get it?
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important issue. Worldwide, cervical cancer has disproportionate burden in the low and middle income countries. And as you say, that's because they haven't been able to introduce cervical screening programs. It may be that some of those countries never introduce cervical screening programs, but will be able to introduce vaccines. There's huge interest both on the U.S. government perspective, but also the World Health Organization and important donor foundations like the Gates Foundation in accelerating access of new vaccine tools for resource-poor countries. The HPV vaccine that we're using here, the four HPV type vaccine that Merck produces, may or may not be the perfect formulation for the poorest countries where cervical cancer deaths are high. There are a lot of studies going on right now with a variety of vaccines, both to understand what are the types that are common in some of these communities, because, as you said, there's like 100 different types of this virus, and there are many that can cause cancer. And then also to understand how does this vaccine perform? Is it as effective? Is it safe? Or one of multiple vaccines? How well do they work in these communities? I think it's also an opportunity really to jumpstart what we hope to see in the future for AIDS vaccines. The HPV vaccine is here. We have one licensed in this country. There's another vaccine being studied that probably will be licensed at some point. And so rather than the eventual hope for an AIDS vaccine and how will we give that out and what kind of prevention opportunities will that give, in the short term, we're going to have some opportunities to really make a difference in health impact for cervical cancer for women all over the world. There's a science base we have to develop before that reality will occur, but I think it's going to be the big exciting issue of the next 10 years, really.
Now, you mentioned that there was another vaccine in development. Is that the GlaxoSmithKline
right.
Cervarix?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you pronounce
right.
it?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
perhaps that would be approved this year? Or do you know?
Yeah, I don't know about the timing. That vaccine has two types in it. It's got 16 and 18, which are the types that are associated with cervical cancer, causing 70% of cervical cancer. It doesn't have the 6 and 11, which are the types associated with 90% of genital warts. but it's being studied. It's also a three-dose schedule, and, you know, it's in advanced stages of study, so I think that we'll have to keep our eye on the FDA for news about its eventual review and whether it gets approved or not.
We had another email wanting to know if there are any prognostications of how many people are actually going to get vaccinated this year and then over the long term over the next few years. Do you have any idea how many people you're expecting to actually get this vaccine in 2007 and then looking out, say, 5 years?
You know, we usually, with a new vaccine introduction, think of it taking about 5 years from introduction to implementation, to full implementation. So when we're tracking at the national level, you know, how are we doing, we say within 5 years of a new vaccine introduction, we want to make sure 90% of the recommended age group has gotten the vaccine. Well, those estimates were sort of, that's based on, you know, how long it's taken to really get everybody in the tent. With HPV, our estimates of, you know, how much vaccine to purchase or prepare for, we're sort of expecting a brisker uptake because of the interest and the communication that's already gone on. So just in our projections of this year versus, you know, the HPV uptake versus perhaps the Tdap uptake, we're thinking it'll probably, it might be as much as double the Tdap uptake. On the other hand, I think they both should be brisk because you can do them at the same visit. The thing is, you just have to bring the child back for the second and third dose with HPV. So the general idea is by 5 years from now, we really want to get 90% of 11 to 12-year-olds to have gotten the three-dose series. Whether we'll get there quicker or it'll take longer, all these issues we've been talking about will be the cause of.
And we got an email from someone who works in a clinic in Wisconsin wanting to know if she has to obtain parental consent. If someone comes into her clinic who's in 13 or 14 years old, does she actually have to get parental consent for it? Renee Jenkins, can you speak to that?
Yes, at this time, most vaccines require parental consent. That's not one of the conditions that's opted out for a minor to give their own consent. I think that's back to the issue that you brought up about whether you see it as a prevention of STD or prevention of cancer screening. And right now, I think for an 11 to 12-year-old, it's looked at as prevention for cancer screening, and it requires a parent's consent.
And we got another email as well wondering if it has been considered at all if pharmacists would be a vehicle for getting this vaccine out. Can you speak to that, Ann Truckett?
Right. In several states, pharmacists are able to give vaccines, while in other states they're not allowed to. A physician has to do it. So depending on the state rules, pharmacists may or may not be allowed to give out the vaccine. In general, as we look to more and more vaccines being recommended for routine use, and our hopes to get more and more people their annual flu vaccine, we really are thinking of how to expand the pool of providers who are able to vaccinate the very large population. So for those listening to this broadcast who haven't yet gotten their flu vaccine, it's not too late. The vaccine could still be useful, and there are more doses than we've ever had in this country. So I think that, and pharmacists are an important part now of the flu vaccine delivery system. So I think that's an issue that will emerge. There's a lot of creative thinking going on about who and where we will get the HPV vaccine delivered. Maybe the first dose here and then a referral to a doctor's office. But I think it's going to be an exciting phase in healthcare utilization.
But certainly with the idea that it's a longitudinal kind of process that you've got to be involved in terms of getting the vaccine to continue, I think the optimal opportunity is still within a medical home for a young person to get it, especially at 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. But certainly there are other options people have to consider, but I think the optimal option is within a medical home for this age group.
Yeah, and there's a lot of education that's important, you know, that it's not just a one-time deal,
absolutely,
that there are lots of other health messages to deliver. So if we think about who our provider pool is, we also want to think about what they're delivering. It's not just a vaccine. It's a whole set of health messages. There's also the issue of tracking, and I think more and more states and localities are using immunization information systems or registries. I mean, D.C. has one of the best registries in the country. And those are terrific tools to help with reminders and recalls. Oh, wait a minute, I'm due for my next shot. To help with that school documentation. Did I get it? I don't know. Oh, it's in the registry. We have, you know, printout proof. So I think we'd really like those kinds of information technology systems to be helping us so that wherever you got your vaccine, your medical home can get that information. And we really use technology for the benefit of children and women.
We also got a number of emails about vaccinating people older than age 26, and obviously the vaccine's not approved for that. But can you talk about whether or not that could be something going forward in the future, if that might be approved, since this is the most common sexually transmitted infection?
Right. There's nothing magic that happens at 27 in terms of how women behave. I don't think so. It's a long time ago, actually.
That's my experience.
Right. But the reason we focused on 26 is actually that the studies were done in 9 to 26-year-olds. We have information on immune response, effectiveness, and safety in that pool of people, and that at a population level, the chances that you've been exposed to at least one of the types of HPV increase with age. Of course, they really increase with sexual activity and number of sexual partners, and you know whether your one sexual partner has had other sexual partners. But I think that, as I understand it, studies are ongoing in older women, older young women, to see what happens after 26. But in terms of the modeling, the economics, the effectiveness, it really looks like if we can get this age group, you know, the 11 to 12-year-olds as a routine ongoing thing, and this catch-up through 26, we will have taken a big bite out of the cervical cancer problem in the country.
We also had a number of questions about if a woman has already been infected with one of the particular strains. And let's say the immune system has cleared it. What is the effect of the vaccine on the woman? So would she be protected from getting that same strain again?
You know, although there's been a huge amount of science carried out about HPV and cervical cancer, we don't have all the answers. The immune response to natural infection as well as to the vaccine we can measure, but we really don't know what the predictor of immune protection or, no longer being susceptible to HPV is. So it's what we do know is that if you've already been exposed to one of the HPV types that's in the vaccine, we think the vaccine will still benefit you in protecting you against the other viral types. On the other hand, we don't think it'll protect you against the type you've already been exposed to. The chances that a 9 to 26-year-old will have already been exposed to all four types are minuscule, and that's why we've recommended this without any kind of screening to figure out if you've ever seen one of these viruses. But we don't have a perfect answer for, you know, are you immune to ever getting that particular strain, because the understanding of the immunology is not perfect yet.
Now, Renee Jenkins, I know that most of the population that you serve are vaccines for children population, but what advice would you give to a clinician who wants to provide this vaccine and, say, has it in stock and wants to try and find a funding source for the particular girl, let's say, if she doesn't have vaccines for children? Would you suggest they call the insurance company, or are there resources out there that the Academy would provide for people who are trying to figure out exactly how to get this paid for?
Well, at this point, the Academy does not have a mechanism to assist people. I think we're looking at the Merck as the company to come up with, you know, various strategies to assist people. But certainly, again, in my sort of quick and dirty survey of my SAM members, people are recommending that folks call their insurance companies. There are also people, I got one email from someone who is in a state where it's not approved by VFC yet, or they don't have the supply, but they've worked out something with the Medicaid people that they will reimburse them if they use one of the commercial supplies. So I think people are trying to be pretty creative about how they get it funded, and people are being a lot more assertive, and perhaps the Academy people within a state are being more assertive at the state level. Because again, I think you pointed out, a lot of this is really determined on a state level in terms of how the federal funding sometimes gets carried out in terms of supplies. It's very much controlled by that state. And so our Academy chapters probably are operating at that level, at the state level, really working things out so that the vaccine is more available, even sometimes before the supply for VFC comes in.
Most of the children should be eligible. Even if they're underinsured, they should be eligible, but they can't necessarily get it through their doctor, and they would have to go through to a public clinic to get the vaccine.
Yeah, there's the VFC program officially covers anyone up to age 19, up through age 18, who is Medicaid eligible, who is uninsured, who is American Indian or Native Alaskan, or who is underinsured and is getting care at a federally qualified health center or rural health center. The issue is that the federally qualified health centers and rural health centers aren't necessarily covering every single person out there who's underinsured, and whether there's one near where you live that you could go to, because your private doctor might not be allowed to give the VFC vaccine to you if you're underinsured. You have to go to this other place. But through age 18, we think there are a lot of resources for that. The poorest people, it's really the 19 to 26-year-old, where it's pretty hard to know how to help make sure we get uptake.
I think this all kind of highlights how fragmented our whole health system is in terms of even just healthcare delivery and healthcare financing, and that you have to, I mean, it's still, it's, the fragmentation, I think, really highlights how hard, or it makes this even harder to implement. And more challenges in terms of both getting through the delivery system and getting your services paid for.
And there have been a few studies out about how parents are actually accepting this vaccine message. Elena Salganikov, can you talk about that a little bit, how parents are actually accepting it?
My understanding is that once this is explained to parents, they're actually very open to it and very excited about it. And I think that the hurdle to overcome is to actually educate parents. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know Merck has this very large campaign right now, and I think that people are noticing that, but I think also in terms of the role of healthcare providers as well, in terms of educating parents. Once they know about it, my sense is that they really don't have any objections, and they want to protect their daughters.
Mm-hmm. There are a few surveys, and the majority of parents do want to protect their daughters. Even surveys, I think the Canadians have a survey out, because they also are now giving girls in Canada this vaccine that parents are very accepting once they understand.
You know, I think this is a really exciting women's health issue. You know, if you look at studies, women are usually the source of health information for their family. Women know about pap tests. They're kind of used to getting them. It's one of those very high recognition issues. And it's pretty exciting to find out that there's a vaccine that can actually prevent that cervical cancer that you've heard about or you know someone who had. So I think this is, we do have challenges with education around vaccine-preventable diseases. Some of the vaccine-preventable diseases are quite rare now because our vaccines are so effective. But I think with a new vaccine against cervical cancer and women as the gatekeeper to the family's health information, we have a really exciting opportunity going on. And again, a chance for that educational discussion at home or with the provider. So I think it's, you know, this has been really heartening as someone who's in the immunization field to see the community interest in this product.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much to all of you for joining us for our discussion today. The hour always goes by very quickly. Dr. Anne Schuckett, Dr. Renee Jenkins, and Dr. Elena Salganikov, thanks again for joining us today. And thanks to all of you for your email questions. On the webcast page, you'll find some helpful resources on the HPV vaccine, including a new fact sheet put together by the Foundation's Women's Health Policy Group. We appreciate your tuning in. I'm Jill Braden-Balderas with KaiserNetwork.org.